this is what some of my sources were saying, first or second gen immigrants that are raised here, their perception of mental health is now the same as the Western perception. So they're no longer able to communicate in the same way as their parents or grandparents about what mental health is, and it causes a huge disconnect.
I'm using these women of color, including myself and my identities, in order to tell the story and really move this conversations forward rather than pointing fingers at the individuals who are perpetuating the system of whiteness and colonialism.
I'm Julia Fioni.
I'm Mira Khanna.
I'm Simran Singh.
And I'm Inwella Vega. This is Center Scope.
Hey everyone, and welcome back. On this episode of Center Scope, we're joining the newsroom surrounding our special edition week in covering health and wellness. So we thought, what better than to have some great conversation from a couple of our reporters and get a gist of the stories they've been working on for the past few weeks. So without further ado, let's get into it. So for our first guest, we have our managing editor extraordinaire, Kirti Vyas. She wrote about how industries in North America have been prone to culturally appropriating religious practices, such as yoga, astrology, as well as homeopathic remedies. So to start us off, how did you come up with the idea to write about this particular topic?
Well, I guess it came from my personal experiences as a Hindu woman of color myself. I've been in the health and wellness industry from the journalism side. I've worked with a travel magazine since I was 19 years old. And when the idea came about for the special editorial project, I personally felt like it was almost describing my life story because of the fact that, like, I have witness cultural appropriation of my religion, of others' cultures, their religions, their spiritual practices within the industry itself. And I just felt like, especially right now, during a time of so much social and racial unrest, this industry really needs to have a racial reckoning and understand simply the fact that what they're doing is not okay. And, you know, we need to pave the way forward for women of color, because a lot of the different types of coverage that you see regarding health and wellness industry tend to primarily focus on white women who, you know, use Hinduism, use Buddhism and indigenous spiritual practices kind of as a way to capitalize and profit off of other cultures. So when I first saw this editorial project, I just immediately knew that I want to speak about my personal experiences as well as focus on the women of color whose voices are often unheard in the industry or not as loud or promoted as much, and who deserve the recognition for the work that they're doing in order to kind of bring this industry back to its main roots of what it really means to be in the health and wellness industry.
That's incredible. And thank you so much for sharing that. I was wondering, in terms of specifics, what were certain examples of cultural appropriation that you noticed?
The biggest thing that we have seen is the yoga movement. So basically, the yoga industry is very prominent within the health and wellness sphere. And as we all know, yoga is a spiritual practice that dates back 5,000 years into ancient Hinduism, Hindu scriptures and texts such as the Vedas. And the main point of yoga in itself, for instance, is a means of finding liberation within oneself in order to achieve a higher sense of self and spirituality. And for Hindus, it's a practice that you use to get closer to God, especially once you pass away. And it's been cultivated and turned into this new white women movement for middle-aged women who are able-bodied, who are thin and the typical package that you would see when it comes to promoting these sorts of experiences as a fitness movement for some reason, and completely negating the whole spiritual aspect of it and the whole community's feel for this.
I mean, that's fascinating. Even speaking for myself, coming from a South Asian background, it's pretty disheartening to know that Western culture has gone this far with regards to appropriation. And that's just yoga being one example of many. So I'd also love to know, who were some of the primary voices in your story?
I mainly spoke to first a woman named Robin LaCambra, who runs a Good Body Field Movement Studio in Hamilton, Ontario. And she's a Filipino woman, and she has a variety of different intersectionalities, such as the fact that she's queer, she also has a invisible physical disability. She's also, a woman of color considering she's Filipina. And just to also speak to Robin's character as well, too, last summer there was a racial reckoning that had kind of occurred due to the Black Lives Matter movement, especially within the health and wellness industry. and a wellness studio named Misfits had actually seen a number of people of color, instructors and students alike, drop out and quit the studio because they had felt that the white owner had been largely catering towards the more affluent and privileged white women-based audience that they were trying to capture, and basically leaving all these instructors and students of colors in the mix. So she was, I guess you can say, an individual who worked there, but had recognized that the problem that's happening in this industry is not specific to just one studio, but in fact, it's institutional. It's in its very roots. And I also spoke to two Black women who co-founded an institution called The Village, which is a wellness community, as they like to call themselves. And their names are Chanel McKenzie and Kim Knight. One is Jamaican and one is from the Grenadines. And they too also use their experiences as Black women in the industry and their feelings of harassment and, I guess you can say, marginalization in order to kind of create that community feel that they were so much longing for so long. And yeah, I spoke to them, and I also spoke to the owner of a zero-waste eco shop in Kensington Market, Wan Lu, who is a registered dietitian right now in Toronto, and she basically caters mostly to ethnic communities within the health and wellness space in order to kind of help treat patients with medicinal herbs or using food as a way, which is very prominent within Hinduism culture and other South Asian religions, to I guess you can say, diagnose patients as well as treat them. And I guess, like, the final source I kind of want to say, instead of kind of, like, making this about myself, it's, like, it's myself. I have experiences as well, too, as a journalist. This is a personal essay. And I'm using these women of color, including myself and my identities, in order to tell the story and really move this conversations forward rather than pointing fingers at the individuals who are perpetuating the system of whiteness and colonialism.
Did you face any difficulties or challenges finding BIPOC speakers that owned establishments or taught classes from their respective cultures?
Yes. I feel a bit ashamed to admit it, but it also goes to show how systemic this problem is. The fact that I could not find even one South Asian or Hindu or Buddhist yoga or wellness instructor to speak to me about this issue speaks volumes about the fact that, like, you know, white women have kind of taken over this entire industry and they're profiting off of an industry that and a culture that's not theirs. And specifically, when it came to actually finding sources, I literally had to go and check other news sources in order to find previous coverage and see whether or not spaces were owned by BIPOC communities, whether they were from people who were actively trying to be intentional in their work. And that also goes to show, like, when I did my Google search, the first time I tried looking for sources for this assignment, majority of the yoga and wellness spaces that had come up and the practitioners were white women, all a certain age, they all had a certain look, and they all had a certain vibe to them, which obviously embodied an entire fake persona, you know, focused on, like, you know, compassion and virtue and all of that package that they're trying to profit off of them, but not necessarily, I guess, really provide it within their teachings and to their communities. So,
what were some of your main takeaways from the piece?
Oh, wow. So I guess that's the main takeaway while I write this piece is the fact that there is hope for the future. The way in which these Black women and Filipino women, as well as Taiwanese women who had spoken to me, it made me feel very hopeful for the future. Because here's the thing. These women have been in the industry all their lives. They're about, like, 15 years in, and they know the rounds. They have been in spaces that are largely white. They've felt ostracized. They've felt othered. And they know what makes a great industry and what does not make a great industry and what makes a business successful and inclusive to all. And from what I got from all my conversations throughout my research is that there are people in the industry who are actively working towards decolonizing these systems of oppression that, you know, led to the basically whitewashing of this entire industry. And it will take some time, especially considering the fact that the only people who get representation, the people who get the brand deals, the people who get to be, the people who get all the money, per se, within the industry, always are white women who overprice their services in order to kind of, like, make a quick buck. That is going to take some time to change. However, I genuinely find that these women of color are the key to, and they are the solution to making change in this industry. And it makes me so proud because I don't even know these people. Like, I've never even met them face-to-face due to COVID. But, like, I feel like I could connect with them. I resonated with their ideologies and the way they spoke about their allies and just knowing when to speak up and just knowing that now is the time to speak up and not feeling afraid and coming into their own was just so inspiring for me to watch as a woman of color, you know, entering the field of journalism and potentially even continuing within the health and wellness space. It just made me so proud to be a woman of color. And we've entered this interesting, I guess you can say, generation, this new resistance against these colonial powers that are actively working to kind of push us down, but we are the light that are bringing and uplifting our own communities up. And the thing is, it just showed me so many different things about how we need to look at this whole situation as a solutions approach. Like, yes, we have raised awareness, but now we actually have to be taking action and being mindful of our words and our practices in order to create these spaces, you know? And this could include a myriad of different things. So, for instance, making the industry more accessible to individuals who are in a more financially precarious situation, so making them more accessible. The whole move to online, making sure that businesses are hybrid and making sure that they're offered online as well as in person as well too, so you can cater to a range of different communities also from around the world. You know, offering scholarships in order for individuals to engage with them, creating sometimes, you know, Black only or Indigenous only or just like BIPOC only spaces in which people know that they're being heard and then they're being like seen, I guess you can say, and just a place where people can act in a community rather than individualize themselves and be fragmented in society.
And lastly, you spoke with your sources about whether or not they noticed a change in BIPOC clientele since the Black Lives Matter protests, an advocacy that became especially prominent last summer after George Floyd. After writing this piece and speaking with your sources, what do you think the future of making an effort to be more inclusive in these spaces will look like?
I guess to answer the first part of your question, all my sources had surprisingly noted that the number of participants had actually increased and they had largely been from BIPOC communities. So that was a plus because they need to see this representation in order to feel safe enough to engage in these spaces. So that's something I noticed. But even prior to the Black Lives Matter movement that had occurred last summer, these yoga studios, these dietitians, all these wellness spaces had been consistently seeing only BIPOC communities coming towards them. So I think that speaks greater volumes about the fact that these businesses have been doing a great job since the beginning, even pre-COVID and post-COVID. I am 100% sure that they will continue to grow and act as spaces that are positive for people's mental health and actually speak to the issues that are, you know, permeating the entire industry.
Features editor Pia Araneta has been working on a story surrounding the need for culturally specific mental health supports. She says that mainly mental health spaces are predominantly white and aren't able to guide and speak to the many microaggressions, racism, and culturally specific issues that some communities might be facing. So here to tell us more about her findings, we've got Pia in the virtual building. So how did you come up with this story idea?
Yeah, so this was pretty interesting. I was actually looking at a GoFundMe that happened in Vancouver maybe at the beginning of this year. And this girl actually, she crowdfunded and raised over $200,000 to fund free therapy sessions for the Black community in Vancouver, which I thought was really interesting, you know. And she was saying that it's because there's not a lot of mental health support specific for the Black community there. And so kind of taking that idea and looking into it, I was kind of asking myself, okay, well, why does there need to be specific supports for Black communities, for BIPOC communities? And it's so essential, and it's happened, like, it's something we need in every city, because unfortunately not every service is equipped to handle the lived experiences of BIPOC community members. So we need specific supports for it. So yeah, I thought it was a really interesting project, and I kind of wanted to look into, you know, why every place can't be equipped. Is there enough cultural competency training? And essentially what the mental health state of BIPOC communities right now, especially during a pandemic.
And based on your findings, what were some of the most common issues your sources were experiencing with the lack of BIPOC therapists or support groups?
A very common thing with my sources, you know, I think that majority of people our age are really comfortable talking about mental health and understanding when they might need to seek that support. But a couple of my sources were talking about, yeah, you know, I did go to therapy, except I could only speak about so much, and they could only relate so much to my experiences. So they weren't really progressing enough in their mental health, and they felt like they, you know, it wasn't worth it in the end, especially with how much therapy costs. So it's a lot of white space. And what I mean by that is literally that. Like, I feel like a lot of therapists are white, and there's not really any race-based collected data in Canada of the mental health workforce. But in terms of the US, if it's anything like that, it's something like 86% of psychologists are white, which is huge. In terms of why whiteness could be problematic in these mental health fields is essentially, you know, if you're not checking your own bias, that it's unconscious bias, if you're not checking that bias, if you're not approaching BIPOC communities in a different lens, a non-Eurocentric, non-colonialist lens, then essentially you might be causing inadvertent harm to these communities as well.
I mean, that is quite relatable, especially for those in the BIPOC Gen Z demographic. I'm curious to know, though, did any of your sources struggle with cultural stigmas when needing to address their mental health?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this is something that so many BIPOC and immigrant people can relate to. You know, when I was even speaking to my sources, it's something that I definitely related to myself as a Filipina. So yeah, that's one thing that definitely needs to be considered. Yes, mental health services can be really inaccessible for these communities. But we also have to really kind of look at what mental health actually means within their cultures as well. You know, not a lot of people look at mental health in the same lens the way we do in Western societies. So essentially, speaking to culture and immigration, you know, in my research, I found that people who come to Canada are actually generally in good shape mentally, with their health, but that actually starts to go away after about 5 years or so. So that raised some red flags for me. You know, I was kind of like, okay, well, what is that really saying? Well, to me, that's saying that people are coming here. Western ideals of mental health and values are being reinforced upon them. And then in turn, their mental health is deteriorating, which is quite tragic, honestly. And then you have that extra layer of, you know, this is what some of my sources were saying. First or second gen immigrants that are raised here, their perception of mental health is now the same as the Western perception. So they're no longer able to communicate in the same way as their parents or grandparents about what mental health is, and it causes a huge disconnect. So families don't know how to communicate with each other in the same way anymore. And also in some cultures, mental health is still stigmatized. You know, it can be seen as a weakness or a taboo. And, you know, it is great here that we are starting to have more open conversations, but you kind of have to think, like, at what cost, really? You know, if children are learning a Eurocentric value system and narrative of mental health, where I want to mention that as well, I feel like here that happiness and the feeling of happiness is really prioritized as the top sort of goal or prize or success. But, you know, in some cultures, that's not the priority. Some people, even here, are just trying to put food on the table, you know? So thinking about mental health can be a luxury, even.
I mean, that's a really fair point. Mental health and wellness really do feel like a luxury today. And something I'm sure both myself and listeners would love to know is, what does it mean when mental health is quote-unquote westernized? And in today's society, what is considered to be the grand pursuit of happiness, especially within North American culture?
Essentially, that kind of trails back, yes, to the history of mental health and the mental health field and where that came from, as we were talking to. But second, kind of back to that immigration thing as well, in terms of what mental health and what good mental health looks like based off Eurocentric values, that looks like happiness to people, you know, trying to achieve the goal of happiness. And this is kind of a side note, but I feel like here that's also sometimes synonymous with financial success. So truly, I'm not quite sure what the main goal would be. Happiness and financial success, I guess. But yeah, essentially, when you have these values in mind, this is what, you know, the immigrant children, the children of BIPOC community members, this is what they're learning, and this is how they see mental health. And, you know, if no one is happy or truly, quote unquote, whatever that means, super happy, then people can start thinking, well, my mental health is really deteriorating. I want to be happy. People have different priorities, especially in other cultures where, you know, happiness might not be the main goal. You know, just having stability in life, a good family, being able to put food on the table, you know, those are priorities as well. But I feel like when you consider Western mental health, when you look at what a picture of that or the other side might look like, you think, oh, well, they don't look happy. Their mental health must be bad. So it just reinforces all these strange notions of what mental health is, how families are experiencing it. And again, as I said, I feel like that causes a huge disconnect with how children relate to their parents. It seems like a huge vicious cycle, to be honest.
If there's one thing to take away from this episode, that is how important it is to educate ourselves and remain accountable for our actions. Sometimes, we don't always realize what we're doing can be hurtful towards others and ourselves. Respecting someone's traditional customs is more than simply acknowledging it, but it's understanding it. Needless to say, we have a long way to go with regards to health and wellness. So I want to thank Kirti and Pia for joining us and broadening our understanding on the importance of health and wellness for BIPOC communities. CenterScope is a production of the Ryersonian and the Ryerson School of Journalism. I'm your host, Simran Singh. Our co-reporters and co-hosts are Julia Fioni and Mira Khanna. This week's episode was mixed by our executive producer, Manuela Vega, and Julia Fioni. Our editor-in-chief is Abhi Raheja, and our managing editor is Kirti Vyas. Our instructors are Peter Baker-George and H.G. Watson. Be sure to check out the Ryersonian for more information on the stories covered in today's episode. Well, that's the scope, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.